We're businessmen, Avi says. We make money. Gold is worth money.
Gold is the corpse of value,
says Goto Dango. I don't understand.
If you want to understand, look out the window,
says the patriarch, and sweeps his cane around in an arc that encompasses half of Tokyo.
50 years ago, it was flames. Now it is lights. Do you understand? The leaders of Nippon were stupid. They took all of the gold out of Tokyo and buried it in holes in the ground in the Philippines, because they thought that the general would march into Tokyo and steal it. But the general didn't care about the gold. He understood that the real gold is here.
He points to his head.
In the intelligence of the people, and here.
He holds out his hands.
In the work that they do. Getting rid of our gold was the best thing that ever happened to Nippon. It made us rich. Receiving that gold was the worst thing that happened to the Philippines. It made them poor.
Then let's get it out of the Philippines, Avi says, so that they too can have the opportunity to become rich.
Ah, now you are making sense,
says Goto Dango.
You are going to take that gold out and dump it into the ocean, then?
No, Avi says, with a nervous chuckle. Goto Dango raises his eyebrows.
Oh, so you wish to become rich as part of the bargain?
At this point, Avi does something that Randy's never seen him do or even come close to doing before. He gets pissed off. He doesn't flip the table over or raise his voice, but his face turns red. The muscles of his head bulge as he clenches his teeth together, and he breathes heavily through his nose for a while. The Gotos both seem to be rather impressed by this, and so no one says anything for a long time, giving Avi a chance to regain his cool. It seems as though Avi can't bring words forth, and so finally he takes his wallet out of his pocket and flips through it until he's found a black-and-white photograph, which he pulls from its transparent sleeve and hands it across to Goto Dango. It's a family portrait. Father, mother, 4 kids, all with a mid-20th century middle European look about them.
My great-uncle, Avi says, and his family. Warsaw, 1937. His teeth are down in that hole. You buried my uncle's teeth.
Goto Dango looks up into Avi's eyes, neither angry nor defensive, just sad. And this seems to have an effect on Avi, who softens, exhales finally, breaks eye contact.
I know you probably had no choice,
Avi says, but that's what you did. I never knew him or any of my other relatives who died in the Shoah. But I would gladly dump every ounce of that gold into the ocean, just to give them a decent burial. That's what I'll do if you make it a condition. But what I was really planning on doing was using it to make sure that nothing of the kind ever happens again.
Goto Dango ponders this for a while, looking stone-faced out over the lights of Tokyo. Then he unhooks his cane from the edge of the table, jams it into the floor, and shoves himself to his feet. He turns towards Avi, straightens his posture, and then bows. It's the deepest bow Randy's ever seen. Eventually, he straightens up and retakes his seat. The tension has been broken. Everyone's relaxed, not to say exhausted.
General Wing is very close to finding Golgotha, Randy says, after a decent interval has ticked by. It's him or us.
It's us, then,
says Goto Dango. R.I.P. The clamor of the Marines' rifles echoes through the cemetery, the sharp reports pinging from tombstone to tombstone like pachinko balls. Goto Dango bends down and thrusts his hand into a pile of loose dirt. It feels good. He scoops up a handful of the stuff. It trickles out from between his fingers and trails down the legs of his crisp, new United States Army uniform
getting caught in the trouser cuffs. He steps to the sharp brink of the grave and pours the earth from his hand onto the general issue coffin containing Bobby Shafto. He crosses himself, staring at the coffin lid stained with dirt, and then, with some effort, lifts his head up again towards the sunlit world of things that live. Other than a few blades of grass and some mosquitoes, the first living thing that he sees is a pair of feet and sandals made from old Jeep tires, supporting a white man wrapped in a shapeless brown garment of rough fabric with a large hood on the top. Staring out from the shade of that hood is the supernaturally weird-looking, in that he has a red beard and gray hair, head of Enoch Root, a character who keeps bumping into Goto Dango as he goes around Manila trying to carry out his duties. Goto Dango is seized and paralyzed by his wild stare. They stroll together across the burgeoning cemetery.
"You have something you would like to tell me," Enoch says.
Goto Dango turns his head to look into Root's eyes.
"I was told that the confessional was a place of perfect secrets."
"It is," Enoch says.
"Then how did you know? Now what?" "I think your church brothers told you something that you should not know."
"Put this idea out of your mind. The secrecy of the confessional has not been violated. I did not talk to the priest who took your first confession, and if I did, he would tell me nothing."
"Then how do you know?"
Goto Dango asks.
"I have several ways of knowing things. One thing I know is that you are a digger, a man who engineers big holes in the ground. Your friend and mine, Father Ferdinand, told me that."
"Yes."
"The Nipponese went to much trouble to bring you here. They would not have done this unless they wanted you to dig an important hole."
"There are many reasons they might have done this."
"Yes," Enoch Root says, "but only a few that make sense."
They stroll silently for a while. Root's feet kick the hem of his robe out with each step.
"I know other things," he continues. "South of here, a man brought diamonds to a priest. This man said he had attacked a traveler on the road and taken from him a small fortune in diamonds. The victim died of his injuries. The murderer gave the diamonds to the church as penance."
"Was the victim Filipino or Chinese?" asks Goto Dango.
Enoch Root stares at him coolly.
"A Chinese man knows of this?"
More strolling. Root will gladly walk from one end of Luzon to the other if that's how long it takes for the words to come out of Goto Dango.
"I have information from Europe, too," Root says. "I know that the Germans have been hiding treasure. It is widely known that General Yamashita is burying more war gold in the northern mountains even as we speak."
"What do you want from me?"
Goto Dango asks. There's no preliminary moistening of the eyeballs. The tears leap out of him and run down his face.
"I came to the church because of some words."
"Words?"
"This is Jesus Christ who taketh away the sins of the world,"
Goto Dango says.
"Enoch Root, no one knows the sins of the world better than me. I have swum in those sins, drowned in them, burned in them, dug in them. I was like a man swimming down a long cave filled with black, cold water. Looking up, I saw a light above me and swam towards it. I only wanted to find the surface to breathe air again. Still immersed in the sins of the world, at least I could breathe. This is what I am now."
Root nods and waits.
"I had to confess. The things that I saw, the things I did, were so terrible. I had to purify myself. That is what I did in my first confession."
Goto Dango heaves a deep, shuddering sigh.
"It was a very, very long confession. But it is finished. Jesus has taken away my sins, or so the priest said."
"Good. I'm glad it helped you."
Now you want me to speak of these things again?
There are others, says Enoch Root. He stops in his tracks and turns and nods, silhouetted on the top of a rise on the other side of several thousand white tombstones, are two men in civilian clothes. They look Western, but that is all Gododengo can tell from here.
Who are they?
Men who have been to hell and come back, as you did. Men who know about the gold.
What do they want?
To dig up the gold. Nausea wraps around Gododengo like a wet bedsheet.
They would have to tunnel down through 1,000 fresh corpses. It is a grave.
The whole world is a grave, says Enoch Root. Graves can be moved, corpses reinterred, decently.
And then, if they got the gold?
The world is bleeding. It needs medicine and bandages. These cost money.
But before this war, all of this gold was out here in the sunlight, in the world. Yet look what happened.
Gododengo shudders.
Wealth that is stored up in gold is dead. It rots and stinks. True wealth is made every day by men getting up out of bed and going to work, by schoolchildren doing their lessons, improving their minds. Tell those men that if they want wealth, they should come to Nippon with me after the war. We will start businesses and build buildings.
Spoken like a true Nipponese, Enoch says bitterly. You never change.
Please make me understand what you are saying.
What of the man who cannot get out of bed and work because he has no legs? What of the widow who has no husband to work, no children to support her? What of children who cannot improve their minds because they lack boots and schoolhouses?
You can shower gold on them,
Gododengo says.
Soon enough, it will all be gone.
Yes, but some of it will be gone into books and bandages. Gododengo does not have a rejoinder for this. He is not outsmarted, so much as sad and tired.
What do you want? You think I should give the gold to the church?
Enoch Root looks mildly taken aback, as if the idea hadn't really occurred to him before. You could do worse, I suppose. The church has 2,000 years of experience in using its resources to help the poor. It has not always been perfect, but it has built its share of hospitals and schools. Gododengo shakes his head.
I have only been in your church for a few weeks, and already I have many doubts about it. It has been a good thing for me, but to give it so much gold, I am not sure if this is a good idea.
Don't look at me as if you expect me to defend the church's imperfections, says Enoch Root. They have kicked me out of the priesthood.
Then what shall I do?
Perhaps give it to the church with conditions.
What?
You can stipulate that it only be used to educate children, if you choose. Gododengo says,
educated men created this cemetery.
Then choose some other condition.
My condition is that if that gold ever comes out of the ground, it should be used so that we do not have any more wars like this one.
And how should we accomplish such a thing, Gododengo? Gododengo sighs.
You put a big weight on my shoulders.
No, I did not put the weight on your shoulders. It has always been there. Enoch Root stares mercilessly into Gododengo's tormented face. Jesus takes away the sins of the world, but the world remains. The physical reality on which we are doomed to live until death takes us away from it. You have confessed, and you have been forgiven, and so the greater part of your burden has been taken away by grace. But the gold is still there in a hole in the ground. Did you think that the gold all turned into dirt when you swallowed the bread and the wine? That is not what we mean by transubstantiation. Enoch Root turns his back and walks away, leaving Gododengo alone in the bright avenues of the City of the Dead. Return. I shall return,
wrote Randy in his first email message to Amy after he got to Tokyo. Returning to the Philippines is not a very good idea at all, and probably not the kind of thing that the old mellow Randy would have even considered. But here he is on a beach in the Sultanate of Kinakuta, down below Tom Howard's personal citadel, dipped in sunblock and dramamined to the gulls, getting ready to return. Reckoning that the goatee would make him easy to identify, he has shaved it off, and reckoning that hair is useless where he's headed, the jungle, jail, and Davy Jones's locker being the three most likely possibilities, has run a buzzer over his head and shorn himself down to about an eighth of an inch all around. This in turn has necessitated finding a hat to prevent radiation burns of the skull, and the only hat in Tom Howard's house that fits Randy is an Outback number that some cephalomegalic Aussie contractor left behind there, evidently because its fragrance had begun to attract nocturnal rodents with a proclivity for aimless gnawing. A pamboat is drawn up on the beach, and a couple of families worth of Bad Hao kids are terrassing around, exactly like kids at a rest area on the interstate who know that in 10 minutes they've got to get back into the Winnebago. The boat's main hull is carved from a single rainforest tree, 50 feet long if it's an inch, narrow enough at its widest point that Randy could sit in the middle and touch both gunwales with outstretched hands. Most of the hull's shaded under a thatched roof of palm fronds, almost all gray-brown from age and salt spray, though in one place an older woman is patching it with fresh greens and plastic twine. On each side, a narrow bamboo outrigger is connected to the hull by bamboo poles. There's a sort of bridge that sticks way out over the bow, painted with bright red and green and yellow curlicues, like chains of vortices thrown off in the wake of a boat and reflecting the colors of a tropical sunset. Speaking of which, the sun's going down right now, and they are making preparations to bring the final load of gold up out of the hull of the pamboat. The land drops so precipitously towards the water that there is no road access to the beach, which is probably a good thing since they want this to be as private as possible. But Tom Howard had a lot of heavy stuff shipped in here when he was constructing his house, and so he already has a short section of narrow-gauge railway in place. This sounds more impressive than it is. A pair of steel I-beams already rusting, bracketed to half-buried concrete ties, running 50 yards straight up a 45-degree slope to a small plateau that's accessible via private road. There he's got a diesel-powered winch that he can use to drag stuff up the rails. It is more than adequate for this evening's job, which is to move a couple of 100 kilograms of bullion, the last of the gold from the sunken submarine, up from the beach and into the vault in his house. Tomorrow, he and the others can truck it into downtown Kinakuta at their leisure and turn it into strings of bits representing very large numbers with noteworthy cryptological properties. The Bad Hows share the same maddening refusal to be exotic that Randy has found everywhere on his travels. The guy who's running the show insists that his name is Leon, and the kids on the beach are forever copying stereotyped martial arts poses and hollering, "Hi-ya!" which Randy knows is a Power Rangers thing because Abby's kids did exactly the same thing until their father banned all Power Ranger emulation inside the house. When the first milk crate full of gold bars is dropped off the high bridge of the pamboat by Leon and half buries itself in the flowery damp sand below, Abby stands over it and tries to utter some kind of solemn prayer for the dead in Hebrew, and gets maybe half a dozen phonemes into it before two of the Bad Hao kids, having pegged him as a permanent stationary object, decide to use him as tactical cover, and take up positions on either side of him, madly hi-yaying each other. Avi's not so full of himself that he can't see the humor in this, and yet not so sentimental that he doesn't obviously want to strangle them. John Wayne is patrolling the surf with a cigarette and a pump shotgun. Douglas MacArthur Shafto rates the probability of frogman attack rather low because the gold in the pamboat is only worth $2.5 million, an amount that hardly rates anything as elaborate and expensive as a seaborne assault. John Wayne needs to be there in case someone gets the mistaken impression that they've somehow managed to pack 10 or 20 times that much gold into the pamboat. This seems improbable from a hydrodynamics standpoint, but Doug says that overestimating the intelligence of the enemy is, if anything, more dangerous than underestimating it. He, Tom Howard, and Jackie Wu are up the hill guarding the roadhead with assault rifles. Tom's been positively strutting. All of his fantasies are coming true in this little tableau. A large plastic box thuds into the sand, breaks open, and spills out a mess of shattered coral. Randy strolls over to it and sees leaves of gold inside the coral carapace, tiny holes punched into them. To him, the holes are more interesting than the gold. But everyone's reacting differently. Doug Shafto's always conspicuously cool and sort of pensive in the presence of a very large amount of gold, like he's always known that it was there, but touching it makes him think about where it came from and what was done to get it there. The sight of a single brick almost made Goto Dango vomit up his Kobe beef. For Eberhard Fur, who is out in the cove doing a lazy backstroke, it is the physical incarnation of monetary value, which for him and the rest of Epiphyte has mostly been a mathematical abstraction, a practical application of one particular sub-sub-sub-branch of number theory. So it has the same kind of purely intellectual attraction to him as a moon rock or a dinosaur tooth. Tom Howard sees it in the embodiment of some political principles that are almost as pure and as divorced from human reality as number theory. Mixed in with that is some sense of personal vindication. For Leon, the sea gypsy, it's just a cargo to be hauled from point A to point B, for which he'll be compensated with something more useful. For Avi, it's an inextricable mixture of the sacred and the satanic. For Randy, and if anyone knew about this, he would be dreadfully embarrassed and would freely admit to its cloyingness, it is the closest thing he's got right now to a physical link with his beloved, in that she was pulling these bars out of the wreck of the submarine just a few days ago. And that is really the only sense in which he gives a damn about it anymore. In fact, in the few days since he decided to hire Leon to smuggle him up the Sulu Sea and into southern Luzon, he has had to remind himself over and over again that the nominal purpose of the trip is to open up Golgotha. After the gold has been unloaded and Leon has taken on some supplies, Tom Howard produces a bottle of single malt scotch, finally answering Randy's question of who patronizes all of those duty-free stores and airports. Everyone gathers on the beach for a toast. Randy's a little edgy when he joins this circle because he's not sure what he's going to propose a toast to if the responsibility falls to him. Unearthing Golgotha? He can't really drink to that. The meeting of minds between Avi and Goto Dango was a spark jumping across an air gap, sudden, dazzling, and a little scary, and it hinged around their common understanding that all of this gold is blood money, that Golgotha is a grave they're preparing to desecrate. So that's not exactly toast material. How about a toast to abstract, lofty principles, then? Here Randy's got another hang-up, something that's been slowly dawning on him as he stands on the beach beneath Tom Howard's concrete house. The perfect freedom that Tom's found in Kinakuta is a cut flower in a crystal vase. It's lovely, but it's dead. And the reason it's dead is that it has been alienated from its germinal soil. And what is that soil exactly? To a first approximation, you could just say America. But it's a little more complicated than that. America's just the hardest-to-ignore instantiation of a cultural and philosophical system that can be seen in a few other places. Not many. Certainly not in Kinakuta. The closest outpost is really not that far away. The Filipinos, for all of their shortcomings in the Human Rights Department, have imbibed the whole Western freedom thing deeply in a way that has arguably made them economic laggards compared to Asian countries, where no one gives a shit about human rights. In the end, it's a moot point. Douglas MacArthur Shafto proposes a toast to smooth sailing. 2 years ago, Randy would have found this to be banal and simple-minded. Now he understands it as Doug's implicit nod to the world's moral ambiguity and a pretty deft preemptive strike against any more inflated rhetoric. Randy downs his scotch in a gulp and then says, "Let's do it," which is also pretty stunningly banal. But this gathering in a circle on the beach thing really makes him nervous. He signed on to participate in a business opportunity, not to join a cabal.
4 days on the Pamboat ensue. It puts along at a steady 10 kilometers per hour, day and night, and it sticks to shallow coastal waters along the periphery of the Sulu Sea. They are lucky with the weather. They stop twice on Palawan and once on Mindoro to take on diesel fuel and to barter for unspecified commodities. Cargo goes down in the hull. People go above it on the deck, which is just a few loose planks thrown crosswise over the gunwales. Randy feels more out-and-out lonely than he has since he was a teenaged geek, but he's not sad about it. He sleeps a lot, perspires, drinks water, reads a couple of books, and dicks around with his new GPS receiver. Its most salient feature is a mushroom-shaped external antenna that can pick up weak signals, which ought to be useful in triple canopy jungle. Randy has punched Golgotha's latitude and longitude into its memory, so that by hitting a couple of buttons he can instantly see how far away it is, along what heading. From Tom Howard's beach is almost exactly 1,000 kilometers. When the Pamboat finally noses up on a tidal mudflat in southern Luzon, and Randy sloshes ashore in full MacArthurian style, the distance is only about 40 clicks. But tumbled-down volcanoes rise before him, black and mist-shrouded, and he knows from experience that 40 kilometers in boondocks will be much rougher going than the first 960. The bell tower of an old Spanish church rises up above the coconut palms not far away, carved from blocks of volcanic tuff that are beginning to glow in the lambency of another damn mind-blowing tropical sunset. After he snagged some extra bottles of water and said his goodbyes to Leon and the family, Randy walks towards it. As he goes, he erases the memory of Golgotha's location from his GPS, just in case it gets confiscated or ripped off. The next thought he has says something about his general frame of mind, that nuts are the genitalia of trees is never more obvious than when you are looking at a cluster of swelling young coconuts nestled in the hairy dark groin of a palm tree. It's surprising that the Spanish missionaries didn't have the whole species eradicated. Anyway, by the time he's reached the church, he's picked up a retinue of little bare-chested Filipino kids who apparently aren't used to seeing white men materialize out of nowhere. Randy's not crazy about this, but he'll settle for no one summoning the police. A Nipponese sport utility vehicle of the adorably styled, alarmingly high center of gravity school is parked in front of the church, ringed by impressed villagers. Randy wonders if they could have done this any more conspicuously. A 50-ish driver leans against the front bumper, smoking a cigarette and shooting the breeze with some local dignitaries. A priest and, for God's sake, a cop with a fucking bolt-action rifle. Just about everyone in sight is smoking Marlboros, which have apparently been distributed as a goodwill gesture. Randy's got to get himself back into a Philippine frame of mind. The way to sneak into the country is not to mount some cloak-and-dagger operation crawling up onto an isolated beach in a matte black wetsuit in the middle of the night, but simply to waltz in and make friends with all of the people who see you. Because it's not like they're stupid. They are going to see you. Randy smokes a cigarette. He had never done this in his life until a few months ago, when he finally got it through his head that it was a social thing, that some people take it as an insult when you turn down an offered cigarette, and that a few smokes weren't going to kill him in any case. None of these people, except for the driver and the priest, speaks a word of English, and so this is the only way he can communicate with them. Anyway, given all the other changes he's gone through, why the hell shouldn't he become a cigarette smoker while he's at it? Maybe next week he'll be shooting heroin. For something disgusting and lethal, cigarettes are amazingly enjoyable. The driver is named Matthew, and he really turns out to be not so much a driver as a charismatic fixer-negotiator, a smoother of the way, a human road grader. Randy just stands there passively while Matthew charmingly and hilariously extricates them from this impromptu village meeting, a job that would probably be next to impossible if the priest were not so clearly complicit. The cop looks to the priest for cues as to what he should do, and the priest tells him something complicated with a series of looks and gestures, and in that way, somehow, Randy finds his way into the sport utility vehicle's passenger seat, and Matthew gets behind the wheel. Well after sunset, they trundle out of the village along its execrable one-lane road, trailed by kids who run alongside, keeping one hand on the car, like Secret Service agents in a motorcade. They are able to do this for quite a while because they've gone a few kilometers before the road gets good enough for Matthew to shift out of first gear. This is not a part of the world where it makes any sense at all to drive at night, but clearly Matthew wasn't interested in an overnight stay at that village. Randy has a pretty good idea of what's going to happen now. Many hours of driving very slowly on circuitous roads, half blocked by piles of freshly harvested young coconuts, impeded by hunks of lumber thrown across the right-of-way as speed bumps to prevent kids and dogs from being run over. He leans his seat back. Bright light is streaming into the car, and he thinks, roadblock, cops, spotlights. The light's blocked by a silhouette. There's a rapping noise on the window. Randy looks over and sees the driver's seat empty. No keys in the ignition. The car's cool and dormant. He sits up and rubs his face, partly because it needs to be rubbed, and partly because it's probably smart to keep one's hands in plain sight. More rapping on the windshield, growingly impatient. The windows are fogged, and he can only see shapes. The light's reddish. He's got a completely inappropriate erection. Randy gropes for a window control, but the car's got power windows, and they don't work when it's not running. He gropes around on the door until he's figured out how to unlock it, and almost instantly it flies open and someone's coming inside to join him. She ends up on Randy's lap, lying sideways on top of him, her head on his chest.
"Ah, close the door,"
Amy says, and Randy does. Then she squirms around until she's face to face with him, her pelvic center of gravity grinding mercilessly against the huge generalized region between navel and thigh that has, in recent months, become one big sex organ for him. She brackets his neck between her forearms and grabs the carotid supports of the whiplash arrester. He's busted. The obvious thing now would be a kiss, and she faints in that direction but then reconsiders, as it seems like some serious looking is in order at this time. So they look at each other for probably a good minute. It's not a moony kind of look that they share, not a starry-eyed thing by any means, more like a what-the-fuck-have-we-gotten-ourselves-into thing. As if it's really important to both of them that they mutually appreciate how serious everything is. Emotionally, yes, but also from a legal and, for lack of a better term, military standpoint. But once Amy is satisfied that her boy does indeed get it, on all of these fronts, she permits herself a vaguely incredulous-looking sneer that blossoms into a real grin, and then a chuckle that, in a less heavily armed woman, might be characterized as a giggle, and then, just to shut herself up, she pulls hard on the stainless steel goalposts of the whiplash arrester and nuzzles her face up to Randy's and, after 10 heartbeats worth of exploratory sniffling and nuzzling, kisses him. It's a chaste kiss that takes a long time to open up, which is totally consistent with Amy's cautious, sardonic approach to everything, as well as with the hypothesis, alluded to once while they were driving to Whitman, that she is in fact a virgin. Randy's life is essentially complete at the moment. He has come to understand during all of this that the light shining in through the window is in fact the light of dawn, and he tries to fight back the thought that it's a good day to die, because it's clear to him that although he might go on from this point to make a lot of money, become famous, or whatever, nothing's ever going to top this. Amy knows it too, and she makes the kiss last for a very long time before finally breaking away with a little gasp for air and bowing her head so that her brow is supported on Randy's breastbone, the curve of her head following that of his throat, like the coastlines of South America and Africa. Randy almost can't take the pressure of her on his groin. He braces his feet against the floorboards of the sport utility vehicle and squirms. She moves suddenly and decisively, grabbing the hem of the left leg of his baggy shorts and yanking it almost up to his navel, taking his boxer shorts along with. Randy pops free and takes aim at her, straining upwards, bobbing slightly with each beat of his heart, glowing healthily, he thinks modestly, in the dawn light.
Amy's in a sort of light wraparound skirt, which she suddenly flings over him, producing a momentary tentpole effect. But she's on the move, reaching up beneath to pull her underwear out of the way, and then before he can even believe it's happening, she sits down on him hard, producing a nearly electrical shock. Then she stops moving, daring him. Randy's toe knuckles pop audibly. He lifts himself and Amy into the air, experiences some kind of synesthetic hallucination, very much like the famous jump into hyperspace scene from Star Wars. Or perhaps the airbag has accidentally detonated. Then he pumps something like an imperial pint of semen. It's a seemingly open-ended series of ejaculations, each coupled to the next by nothing more than a leap of faith that another one is coming. And in the end, like all schemes built on faith and hope, it lapses. And then Randy sits utterly still until his body realizes it has not drawn breath in quite a while. He fills his lungs all the way, stretching them out, which feels almost as good as the orgasm, and then he opens his eyes. She's staring down at him in bemusement, but, thank God, not horror or disgust. He settles back into the bucket seat, which squeezes his butt in a not unpleasant gesture of light harassment. Between that and Amy's thighs and other penetrations, he is not going anywhere for a while, and he's moderately afraid of what Amy's going to say. She has a lengthy menu of possible responses to all of this, most of them at Randy's expense. She plants a knee, levers herself up, grabs the tail of his Hawaiian shirt, and cleans herself off a bit. Then she shoves the door open, pats him twice on his whiskery cheek, says, "Shave," and exits stage left. Randy can now see that the airbag has not, in fact, deployed. And yet he has the same feeling of a major sudden life change that one might get after surviving a car crash. He is a mess. Fortunately, his bag's in the back seat, with another shirt. A few minutes later, he finally emerges from the fogged-up car and gets a look at his surroundings. He's in a community built on a canted plateau with a few widely spaced, very high coconut palms scattered about. Downslope, which appears to be roughly south, there is a pattern of vegetation that Randy recognizes as a tri-leveled cash crop thing. Pineapples down on the ground, cacao and coffee at about head level, coconuts and bananas above that. The yellowish-green leaves of the banana trees are especially appealing, seemingly big enough to stretch out and sunbathe on. To the north, and uphill, a jungle is attempting to tear down a mountain. This compound that he's in is obviously a recent thing, laid out by actual surveyors, designed by people with educations, subsidized by someone who can afford brand new sheets of corrugated tin, ABS drain pipe, and proper electrical wiring. It has something in common with a normal Philippine town in that it's built around a church. In this case, the church is small. Enoch called it a chapel. But that it was designed by Finnish architecture students would be obvious to Randy, even if Root hadn't divulged it. It has a bit of that Bucky Fuller tensegrity thing going for it. Lots of exposed, tensioned cables radiating from the ends of tubular struts, all collaborating to support a roof that's not a single surface, but a system of curved shards. It looks awfully well designed to Randy, who now judges buildings on the sole criterion of their ability to resist earthquakes. Root told him it was built by the Brothers of a Missionary Order, and by local volunteers, with materials contributed by a Nipponese foundation that is still trying to make amends for the war. Music is coming out of the church. Randy checks his watch and discovers that it's Sunday morning. He avoids participating in the Mass, on the excuse that it's already underway and he doesn't want to interrupt it, and ambles toward a nearby pavilion. A corrugated roof sheltering a concrete floor slab with some plastic tables, where breakfast is being laid out. He arouses violent controversy among a loose flock of chickens that is straggling across his path, none of whom can seem to figure out how to get out of his way. They're scared of him, but not mentally organized enough to translate that fear into a coherent plan of action. Several miles away, a helicopter is flying in from the sea, shedding altitude as it homes in on a pad somewhere up in the jungle. It is a big and gratuitously loud cargo-carrying chopper with unfamiliar lines, and Randy vaguely suspects that it was built in Russia for Chinese customers, and that it is part of Wing's operations. He recognizes Jackie Wu lounging at one of the tables, drinking tea and reading a bright magazine. Amy's in the adjacent kitchen, embroiled in girl talk with a couple of middle-aged ladies who are handling the preparations for the meal. This place seems pretty safe, and so Randy stops in the open, punches in the digits that only he and Goto Dengo know, and takes a GPS reading. According to the machine, they are no more than 4,500 meters away from the main drift of Golgotha. Randy checks the heading and determines that it is uphill from here. Although the jungle blurs the underlying shape of the earth, he thinks that it's going to be up in the valley of a nearby river. 4,500 meters seems impossibly close, and he's still standing there trying to convince himself that his memory is sound, when the ragged voices of the worshippers suddenly spill out across the compound as the chapel's door is pushed open. Enoch Root emerges, wearing, inevitably, what Randy would describe as a wizard's robe. But as he walks across the compound, he shucks it off to reveal sensible khakis underneath and hands the robe to a young Filipino acolyte who scurries back inside with it. The singing trails off, and then Douglas MacArthur Shafto emerges from the church, followed by John Wayne and several people who appear to be locals. Everyone drifts towards the pavilion. The alertness that comes with being in a new place, combined with the neurological aftermath of that shockingly big and long orgasm, has left Randy's senses sharper and his mind clearer than they've ever been, and he's impatient to get going. But he can't dispute the wisdom of getting a good breakfast, so he shakes hands all around and sits down with the others. There is a bit of small talk about how his panboat voyage went.
"Your friends should have come into the country that way," says Doug Shafto,
and then goes on to explain that Avi and both of the Gotos were supposed to be here yesterday, but they were detained at the airport for some hours and eventually had to fly back to Tokyo while some mysterious immigration hassles were ironed out. "Why didn't they go to Taipei or Hong Kong?" Randy wonders aloud, since both those cities are much closer to Manila. Doug stares at him blankly and observes that both of those are Chinese cities, and reminds them that their presumed adversary now is General Wing, who has a lot of pull in places like that. Several backpacks have already been prepared, laden mostly with bottled water. After everyone's had a chance to digest breakfast, Douglas MacArthur Shafto, Jackie Wu, John Wayne, Enoch Root, America Shafto, and Randall Lawrence Waterhouse all don packs. They begin to stroll uphill, passing out of the compound and into a transitional zone of big-leaved traveler trees and giant clusters of bamboo, 10-centimeter-thick trunks spraying out and up from central roots like frozen shellbursts to heights of at least 10 meters, the poles striped green and brown where the husky leaves are peeling away. The canopy of the jungle looms higher and higher, accentuated by the fact that it's uphill from here and emits a fantastic whistling noise, like a phaser on overload. As they enter the shade of the canopy, the racket of crickets is added to that whistling noise. It sounds as though there must be millions of crickets and millions of whatever's making the whistling noise, but from time to time the sound will suddenly stop and then start up again. So if there are a lot of them, they are all following the same score. The place is filled with plants that in America are only seen in pots, but that grow to the size of oak trees here, so big that Randy's mind can't recognize them as, for example, the same kind of Diefenbachia that Grandmother Waterhouse used to have growing on the counter in her downstairs bathroom. There is an incredible variety of butterflies for whom the wind-free environment seems to be congenial, and they weave in and out among the huge spiderwebs that call to mind the design of Enoch Root's chapel. But it is clear that the space is ultimately ruled by ants. In fact, it makes the most sense to think of the jungle as a living tissue of ants with minor infestations of trees, birds, and humans. Some of them are so small that they are to other ants as those ants are to people. They prosecute their ant activities in the same physical space, but without interfering, like many signals on different frequencies sharing the same medium. But there are a fair number of ants carrying other ants, and Randy assumes that they are not doing it for altruistic reasons. Where the jungle's dense, it is impassable. But there are a fair number of places where the trees are spaced a few meters apart and the undergrowth is only knee-high, and light shines through. By moving from one such place to another, they make slow progress in the general direction indicated by Randy's GPS. Jackie Wu and Jean Nguyen have disappeared and appear to be moving parallel to them, but much more quietly. The jungle is a nice place to visit, but you wouldn't want to live or even stop moving there. Just as the beggars in Intramuros see you as a bipedal automatic teller machine, the insects here see you as a big slab of animated but not very well-defended food. The ability to move, far from being a deterrent, serves as an unforgeable guarantee of freshness. The canopy's tent poles are huge trees.
Octomalus subatrana, says Enoch Root,
with narrow buttress roots splayed out explosively in every direction, as thin and sharp as machetes sunk into the earth. Some of them are almost completely obscured by colossal philodendrons winding up their trunks. They crest a broad, gentle ridgeline. Randy had forgotten that they were moving uphill. The air suddenly becomes cooler, and moisture condenses on their skins. When the whistlers and the crickets pause, it becomes possible to hear the murmur of a stream down below them. The next hour is devoted to slowly working their way down the slope towards it. They cover a total of 100 meters. At this rate, Randy thinks, it should take them 2 days hiking around the clock to reach Golgotha, but he keeps this observation to himself. As they move downhill, he starts to become aware of, and to be taken aback by, the sheer amount of biomass that happens to be above them, 40 or 50 meters above them in many cases. He feels as though he's at the bottom of the food chain. They enter a sunnier zone that consequently is snarled by much heavier undergrowth, and are forced to break out the machetes and hack their way through to the river. Enoch Root explains that this is a place where a small lahar, which had been funneled between the steep walls of the river's gorge farther upstream, spread out and mowed down a few hectares of ancient trees, clearing the path for smaller, opportunistic vegetation. This is fascinating for about 10 seconds, and then it's back to the machete work. Eventually, they reach the edge of the river, all of them sticky and greenish and itching from the sap and juice and pulp of the vegetation they have assaulted in order to get here. The river's bed is shallow and rocky here, with no discernible bank. They all sit down and drink water for a while.
"What is the point of all this?"
asks Enoch Root suddenly.
"I don't mean to sound discouraged by these physical barriers, because I'm not. But I'm wondering whether you have worked out the goal of it in your own mind."
"This is fact-finding, nothing more," Randy says.
"But there's no point in just aimlessly finding facts unless you're a pure scientist or a historian. You are representing a business concern here, correct?"
"Yes."
"And so if I were a shareholder in your company, I could demand an explanation of why you are sitting here on the edge of this river right now instead of actually doing whatever it is that your company does."
"Assuming you were an intelligent shareholder, yes, that's what you'd be doing."
"And what would your explanation be, Randy?"
"Well,
I know where we are going, Randy."
And Enoch quotes a string of digits.
"How did you know that?"
Randy asks, kind of hotly.
"I've known it for 50 years,
Enoch says.
"Godo Dango told me."
All Randy can do for a while is fume.
Doug Shafto's laughing. Amy just looks distracted.
Enoch broods for a few moments and finally says,
"Originally, the plan was to buy this land with a smaller cache of gold that was dug up and loaded aboard a certain submarine. We would then wait for the right moment and then dig up the rest. But the submarine sank, and the gold sank with it. I sat on the knowledge for many years, but then people started buying up land around here, people who were obviously hoping to find the primary. If I'd had the money, I would have bought this land myself, but I didn't. So I saw to it that the church bought it.
Doug Shafto says,
You haven't answered Enoch's question yet, Randy. What good are you doing your shareholders here?
A red dragonfly hovers above a backwater of the stream, its wings moving so fast that the eyes sees not wings in movement, but a probability distribution of where the wings might be, like electron orbitals. A quantum mechanical effect that maybe explains why the insect can apparently teleport from one place to another, disappearing from one point and reappearing a couple of meters away without seeming to pass through the space in between. There sure is a lot of bright stuff in the jungle. Randy figures that in the natural world, anything that is colored so brightly must be some kind of serious evolutionary badass.
We took the gold that you recovered from the submarine and turned it into electronic cash, right? Randy says.
So you claimed. I haven't actually spent any of that electronic cash yet,
says Doug.
We want to do the same thing for the church, or wing, or whoever ends up in possession of the gold. We want to deposit it in the crypt and make it usable as electronic currency.
Amy asks, Do you understand that in order to move the gold out of here, it'll be necessary to travel across land control by wing? Who says we have to move it?
Silence for a minute, or what passes for silence in a jungle. Doug Shafto says,
You're right. If the stories are even half true, this facility is far more secure than a bank vault.
The stories are all true, and then some, Randy says. The man who designed and built Golgotha is Goto Dango himself.
Shit.
He drew plans of it for us, and the larger issue of local and national security is not a problem here, Randy adds. Of course, the government has sometimes been unstable, but any invader who wants to physically seize possession of the gold will have to fight his way across this jungle with tens of millions of heavily armed Filipinos barring his path.
Everyone knows what the Hucks did against the Nips, Doug says,
nodding vigorously.
Or the VC against us, for that matter. No one would be stupid enough to try it.
Especially if we put you in charge, Doug.
Amy's been wool-gathering through most of the conversation, but at this, she turns and grins at her father.
I accept,
Doug says. Randy's slowly becoming aware that most of the birds and bugs who live here move so fast that you can't even turn your head fast enough to center them in your vision. They exist only as slicing movements in your peripheral vision. The only exception would seem to be a species of gnat that has evolved into the specific niche of plunging into the left eyeballs of human beings at something just under the speed of sound. Randy has taken about 4 hits in the left eye, none in the right. He takes another one now, and as he's recovering from it, the earth jumps underneath him. It is a little like an earthquake in its psychological effect, a feeling of disbelief and then betrayal that the solid ground is having the temerity to move around. But it's all over by the time the sensation has moved up their spines to their brains. The river's still running, and the dragonfly is still hunting.
That felt exactly like high explosive going off, says Doug Shafto. But I didn't hear anything. Did anyone hear anything?
No one heard anything.
What that means, Doug continues, is that someone is setting off explosives deep underground.
They start working their way up the riverbed. Randy's GPS indicates that Golgotha is less than 2,000 meters upstream. The river begins to develop proper banks that get steadily higher and steeper. John Wayne clambers up onto the left bank and Jackie Wu onto the right, so that the high ground on either side will be guarded, or at least reconnoitered. They pass back into the shade of the canopy. The ground here is some kind of sedimentary rock with granite boulders embedded in it from place to place, like mixed nuts and half-melted chocolate. It must be nothing more than a scab of congealed ash and sediment on top of an underlying monolith of hard rock. Those who are down in the stream bed move very slowly now.
Part of the time they are down in the river, struggling upstream against a powerful current, and part of the time they are picking their way from boulder to boulder, or sidestepping along crumbling ledges of harder rock that protrude from the banks here and there. Every few minutes, Doug looks up and makes visual contact with Jackie Wu and John Wayne, who must be contending with challenges of their own because sometimes they fall behind the main group. The trees only seem to get higher as they work their way up into the mountains, and now their height is accentuated by the fact that they are rooted in the top of a bank that rises above the stream 2, 5, 10, then 20 and 30 meters. The bank actually overhangs them now. The river's gorge is a tube, mostly buried in the earth, open to the sky only through a narrow slot in the top. But it's close to midday, and the sun is shining nearly straight down through it, illuminating all of the stuff that makes its way down from the heights. The corpse of a murdered insect drifts down from the upper canopy like winter's first snowflake. Water seeping from the rims of the overhanging bank forms a drip curtain, each drop glittering like a diamond and making it nearly impossible to see the dark cavity behind. Yellow butterflies weave among those falling drops, but never get hit. They come around a gentle bend in the river and are confronted by a waterfall some 20 meters high. At the base of the falls, there's a still and relatively shallow pool filling the bottom of a broad, melon-shaped cavity formed by the concave overhanging banks. The vertical sun beams straight down on the cloud of white foam at the base of the falls, which radiates the light back at blinding power, forming a sort of natural light fixture that illuminates the whole inside of the cavity. The stone walls, sweating and dripping and running with groundwater, glisten in its light. The undersides of the ferns and big-leaved plants, epiphytes, sprouting from invisible footholds in the walls, flicker and dapple in the weirdly bluish foam glow. Most of the cavity's walls are hidden behind vegetation, fragile, cascading veils of moss growing from the rock, and vines depending from the branches of the trees hundreds of feet above them and dangling halfway down into the gorge, where they have become entangled with protruding tree roots and formed a natural trellis for a finer network of creepers that is itself the warp and woof of a matted carpet of moss saturated with flowing groundwater. The gorge is alive with butterflies, burning with colors of radioactive purity, and down closer to the rustling water are damselflies, mostly black, with aqua bodies that flash in the sun, their wings revealing glimpses of salmon and coral red on the underside as they orbit around each other. But mostly the air is filled with this continual slow progress of things that didn't survive, making their way down through the column of air and into the water, which flushes them away. Dead leaves and the exoskeletons of insects, sucked dry and eviscerated in some silent combat hundreds of feet above their heads. Randy's keeping an eye on the display of his GPS, which has been having a hard time locking onto any satellites down in this gorge, but finally some numbers come up. He has it calculate the distance from here to Golgotha, and the answer comes up immediately. A long row of zeros with a few insignificant digits trailing off the end. Randy says, "This is it." But most of what he says is obscured by a sharp explosion from high above them on the bank. A few seconds later, a man begins to scream.
"No one move,"
says Doug Shafto.
"We are in a minefield."
Cribs. On a grassy knoll, a man crouches behind a tombstone, peering through a telescope on a tripod, and tracking the steady pace of a robed and hooded figure across the grass. Funeral. That's the crib that broke these guys. The Nipponese man in the American uniform, whom Enoch Root is leaving behind, must be that Gutto Dengo fella. Lawrence Pritchard Waterhouse has seen that name punched on so many ETC cards that he no longer even has to read the printed letters at the top of the card. He can identify a Gutto Dengo from arm's length simply by glancing at the pattern of punched-out rectangles. The same is true of some 24 other Nipponese mining engineers and surveyors who were brought to Luzon in 43 and 44. in response to Azure Pufferfish messages emanating from Tokyo. But as far as Waterhouse can tell, all of the others are dead. Either that, or they retreated north with Yamashita. Only one of them is alive, well, and living in what is left of Manila, and that's Goto Dengo. Waterhouse was going to rat him out to Army Intelligence, but that doesn't seem like such a good idea now that the unkillable NIP engineer has become a personal protege of the General. Root is heading in the direction of those two mysterious white men who attended Bobby Shafto's funeral. Waterhouse peers at them through the scope, but mediocre optics, combined with the heat waves rising from the grass, complicate this. One of them seems oddly familiar. Odd, because Waterhouse doesn't know that many bearded men with long, swept-back blonde hairdos and black eye patches. An idea springs out of his forehead, fully formed, with no warning. This is how all the best ideas arrive. Ideas that he patiently cultivates from tiny seeds always fail to germinate or else grow up into monstrosities. Good ideas are just there all of a sudden, like angels in the Bible. You cannot ignore them just because they are ridiculous. Waterhouse stifles a giggle and tries not to get overly excited. The dull, tedious, bureaucratic part of his mind is feeling testy and wants a few shreds of supporting evidence. This is quickly supplied. Waterhouse knows and has proved to Earl Comstock that strange information is in the air, dotting and dashing furtively from a small number of feeble transmitters scattered around Luzon and the surrounding waters, encrypted using the Arethusa system. Lawrence and Allen have known for 2 years now that Rudy invented it, and from the decrypts chattering out of digital computers in Bletchley Park and Manila, they now know other things. They know that Rudy flew the coop late in 1943 and probably went to Sweden. They know that one Gunter Bischoff, captain of the U-boat that plucked Shafto and Root out of the water, also ended up in Sweden, and that Dernitz persuaded him to take over the gold-running work that had been performed by U-553 until it ran aground off Tagum. The naval intelligence boys are fascinated by Bischoff, and so he had already been the subject of much research. Waterhouse has seen photos of him from his student days. The shorter of the two men he is peering at now could easily be the same fellow, now middle-aged. And the taller one, the one with the eye patch, could most definitely be Rudy von Heckelhaber himself. It is, then, a conspiracy. They have secure communications. If Rudy is the architect of Arethusa, then it will be essentially impossible to break, except for rare lapses such as this funeral business. They have a submarine. It cannot be found or sunk, because it is one of Hitler's new rocket-fuel-powered babies, and because Gunter Bischoff, the greatest U-boat commander in history, is its skipper. They have, at some level, the backing of the odd brotherhood that Root belongs to, the Ignoti Quasi-Occulti guys. And now they are trying to enlist Goto Dengo, the man who, it is safe to assume, buried the gold. 3 days ago, the Intercept boys in Waterhouse's section picked up a brief flurry of Arethusa messages exchanged between a hidden transmitter somewhere in Manila and a mobile one in the South China Sea. Catalinas were vectored toward the latter and picked up diminishing radar echoes at first, but found nothing when they arrived on the scene. A team of journeyman codebreakers jumped on those messages and started trying to tear them apart by brute force. Lawrence Pritchard Waterhouse, the old hand, went for a stroll along the Manila Bay seawall. A breeze suddenly rose from the bay. He stopped to let it cool his face. A coconut fell from the top of a tree and smashed into the ground 10 feet away. Waterhouse turned on his heel and went back to the office. Just before the flurry of Arethusa messages began, Waterhouse had been sitting in his office listening to Armed Forces Radio. They had broadcast an announcement that 3 days from now, at such and such a time, the funeral for the hero Bobby Shafto was going to be held at the big new cemetery down in Makati. Sitting down in his office with the fresh Arethusa intercepts, he went to work, using funeral as a crib. If this group of 7 letters decrypts to funeral, then what does the rest of the message look like? Gibberish?
Okay, how about this group of seven letters? Even with this gift thrown into his lap, it took him 2.5 days of nonstop work to decrypt the message. The first one, transmitted from Manila, went, "Our friend's funeral Saturday, 10:30 a.m., U.S. Military Cemetery, Makati." The response from the submarine, "Will be there. Suggest you inform GD." He aims the spyglass at Godo Dengo again. The Nipponese engineer is standing with his head bowed and his eyes tightly shut. Perhaps his shoulders are heaving. Perhaps it's just the heat waves that make it seem so. But then Godo Dengo straightens up and takes a step in the direction of the conspirators. He stops. Then he takes another step. Then another. His posture is straightening up miraculously. He seems to feel better with every stride. He walks faster and faster until he is almost running. Lawrence Pritchard Waterhouse is hardly a mind reader, but he can easily enough tell what Godo Dengo is thinking. "I have a burden on my shoulders, and it has been crushing me. And now I'm going to hand that burden over to someone else." Hot damn. Bischoff and Rudy von Heckelhaber step forward to meet him, holding out their right hands enthusiastically. Bischoff, Rudy, Enoch, and Godo Dengo join into a knot, practically on top of Bobby Shafto's grave. It is a shame. Waterhouse knew Bobby Shafto and would have liked to attend his funeral standing up, not skulking around like this. But Enoch Root and Rudy would both recognize him. Waterhouse is their enemy. Or is he? In a decade full of Hitlers and Stalins, it's hard to worry about a conspiracy that seemingly includes a priest and that risks his very existence in order to attend a member's funeral. Waterhouse rolls over and lies on his back on some dead guy's grave and ponders it. If Mary were here, he would lay out the dilemma for her and she would tell him what to do. But Mary's in Brisbane, picking out bridesmaids' dresses and china patterns. The next time he sees any of these fellows is 1 month later in a clearing in the jungle, a couple of hours south of Manila. Waterhouse gets there before they do and spends a sweaty night under a mosquito net. In the morning, about half of Bischoff's submarine crew arrives, grumpy from an all-night march. As Waterhouse expected, they are quite nervous about being ambushed by the local hook commander known as the Crocodile, and so they post a number of sentries in the jungle. That is why Waterhouse took pains to get here before they did, so that he would not have to infiltrate their picket line. The Germans who aren't standing guard go to work with shovels, digging a hole in the ground next to a big piece of red pumice, shaped vaguely like the continent of Africa. Waterhouse squats no more than 20 feet away, trying to figure out how he can make his presence known without being gunned down by a nervous white man. He almost gets close enough to tap Rudy on the shoulder. Then he slips on a slimy rock. Rudy hears him, turns, and sees nothing except for a swatch of undergrowth being torn down by Waterhouse's falling body. "Is that you, Lawrence?" Waterhouse stands up cautiously, keeping his hands in plain sight.
"Very good. How did you know?"
"Don't be stupid. There aren't that many people who could have found us." They shake hands. Then they think better of it and embrace. Rudy gives him a cigarette. The German sailors look on incredulously. There are some others, a Negro and an Indian and a grizzled dark man who looks like he wants to kill Waterhouse on the spot.
"You must be the famous Otto,"
Waterhouse exclaims. But Otto does not seem eager to make new friends or even acquaintances at this juncture in his life and turns away sourly.
"Where's Bischoff?"
Waterhouse asks.
"Minding the submarine. It is risky lurking in the shallows.
How did you find us, Lawrence?"
He answers his own question before Waterhouse can.
"By decrypting the long message, obviously."
"Yes.
But how did you do that? Did I miss something? Is there a back door?"
"No, it wasn't easy. I broke one of your messages a while back."
"The funeral one?"
"Yes."
Waterhouse laughs.
I could have killed Enoch for sending out a message with such an obvious crib.
Rudy shrugs.
It is hard to teach crypto security, even to intelligent men, especially to them.
Maybe he wanted me to decrypt it,
Waterhouse muses. It is possible, Rudy admits. Perhaps he wanted me to break Detachment 2702's one-time pad, so that I would come and join him.
I guess he figures if you're smart enough to break hard codes, you're automatically going to be on his side,
Waterhouse says.
I'm not sure that I agree. It is naive.
It's a leap of faith,
Waterhouse says.
How did you break Arethusa? I am naturally curious,
Rudy says.
Because as your pufferfish employs a different key every day,
I assume that Arethusa did the same.
I call them by different names, but yes, continue. The difference is that the daily key for As Your Pufferfish is simply the numerical date. Very easy to exploit once you have figured it out.
Yes, I intended it that way, Rudy says. He lights up another cigarette, taking extravagant pleasure in it.
Whereas the daily key for Arethusa is something I haven't been able to put my finger on yet. Perhaps a pseudo-random function of the date?
Perhaps random numbers you are taking from a one-time pad? In any case, it is not predictable, which makes Arethusa harder to break.
But you did break the long message. Would you explain how?
Well, your meeting at the cemetery was brief. I guess you had to get out of there pretty fast.
It did not seem a good place to linger.
So, you and Bischoff went away. Back to the submarine, I figured.
Gododango went back to his post at the general's headquarters. I knew that he couldn't have told you anything substantive at the cemetery. That would have to come later, and it would have to be in the form of an Arethusa encrypted message.
You are justifiably proud of Arethusa.
Thank you,
Rudy says briskly.
But the drawback of Arethusa, as with As Your Pufferfish, is that it requires a great deal of computation. This is fine if you happen to have a computing machine or a room full of trained abacus operators.
I assume you have a machine on board the submarine?
That we do,
Rudy says diffidently.
Nothing very special. It still requires a great deal of manual calculation.
But Enoch Root in Manila and Gododango could not have had such a thing. They would have to encrypt the message by hand, doing all of the calculations on sheets of scratch paper.
Enoch already knew the algorithm and could tell it to Gododango, but you would have to agree on a key to put into that algorithm.
The only time you could have decided on the key was while you were all together at the cemetery. And during your conversation there, I saw you pointing at Shafto's headstone. So I figured that you were using that as a key. Maybe his name, maybe his dates of birth and death, maybe his military serial number. It turned out to be the serial number.
But still, you did not know the algorithm.
Yes, but I had some idea that it was related to the As Your Pufferfish algorithm, which in turn is related to the Zeta functions that we studied at Princeton. So I just sat down and said to myself, if Rudy were going to build the ultimate crypto system on this basis, and if As Your Pufferfish is a simplified version of that system, then what is Arethusa? That gave me a handful of possibilities.
And out of that handful, you were able to pick the right one.
No, Waterhouse says. It was too hard. So I went to the church where Enoch was working and looked through his wastebasket.
Nothing. I went to go to Dango's office and did the same.
Nothing.
Both of them were burning their scratch paper as they went along.
Rudy's face suddenly relaxes.
Oh, good. I was afraid they were doing something incredibly stupid.
Not at all. So, you know what I did?
What did you do, Lawrence?
I went and had an interview with Gododango.
Yes, he told us that much.
I told him about the research I'd been doing into Azure Pufferfish, but I didn't tell him I had broken it. I got him talking, in a very general way, about what he was doing on Luzon during the last year. He told me the same story that he has stuck to all along, which is that he was building some minor fortification somewhere, and that after escaping from that area he wandered lost in the jungle for several days, before emerging near San Pablo and joining up with some Air Force troops who were heading north towards Manila.
It's a good thing you got out of there, I told him, because ever since then the Hukbalahop leader who calls himself the Crocodile has been ransacking the jungle. He's convinced that you Nipponese buried a fortune in gold there.
As soon as the word crocodile emerges from Waterhouse's mouth, Rudy's face screws up in disgust and he turns away.
So when the long message was finally transmitted last week from the transmitter that Enoch had hidden on the top of that church's bell tower, I had two cribs. First of all, I suspected that the key was a number from the tombstone of Bobby Shafto. Secondly, I was confident that the words Hukvalahop, crocodile, and probably gold or treasure would appear somewhere in the message. I also looked for obvious candidates like latitude and longitude. With all of that to go on, breaking the message wasn't that hard. Rudy von Heckelhaber heaves a big sigh.
"So, you win," he says. "Where's the cavalry?"
"Cavalry or Calvary?" Waterhouse jokes. Rudy smiles tolerantly.
"I know where Calvary is, not far from Golgotha."
"Why do you think the cavalry is coming?"
"I know they are coming," Rudy says. "Your efforts to break the log message must have required a whole room full of computers. They will talk. Surely the secret is out."
Rudy stubs out his half-smoked cigarette as if preparing to leave.
"So you have been sent to give us an offer. Surrender in a civilized way and we will get good treatment. Something like that."
"Au contraire, Rudy.
No one knows except me. I did leave a sealed envelope in my desk to be open if I should die mysteriously on this little trip to the jungle. And that Otto character has a fearsome reputation."
"I don't believe you. It is impossible," Rudy says.
"You of all people. Don't you see? I have a machine, Rudy. The machine does the work for me, so I don't need a room full of computers, human ones leastways. And as soon as I read the decrypted message, I burned all of the cards. So I am the only one who knows."
"Oh,"
Rudy says, stepping back and looking into the sky, adjusting his mind to these new facts.
"So, I gather that you have come here to join us? Otto will be troublesome about it, but you are quite welcome."
Lawrence Pritchard Waterhouse actually has to think about it. This surprises him a little.
"Most of it is going to help victims of the war, in one way or another," Rudy says. "But if we take a 0.1% as commission and distribute it among the entire crew of the submarine, we are all among the richest men in the world."